Lads, welcome. Happy Provincial Budget Week. Did you both have a good time covering the budget?
To be honest, I don't really cover the budget as much as Dan does. It's not really central to my beat. Dan's the budget master.
Yep. Well, I was in the budget lockup. I did a profile of Finance Minister Adrian Sala before the budget was tabled, and I totally immersed myself in the joys of dissecting the province's summary budget.
What's a summary budget?
I am super glad you asked that, because summary budget is one of my favorite budget topics. So the summary budget is actually part of generally accepted accounting principles.
Oh, man. These were imposed on Dan really knows his stuff, but it's so boring. I got to try to show some interest. I mean, it's really something I got to get up to more speed on. This stuff is so dry. It's like more dry than a Manitoba Hydro Dam reservoir right now. And even though he knows his stuff, God, Dan just goes on and on and on and never stops. Too much to absorb. Must pretend to be interested. Must pretend to be interested. Must pretend to be interested.
But on the other hand, too, it's a very complex subject to decode. Do you guys get all that?
Yep.
Got it.
Thanks. You.
Yeah. Any other questions? You know, I could do debt to equity ratios and
No.
I think we're good.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Welcome, everybody, to Negan and the Lone Ranger, Provincial Budget Edition.
Exciting time of the year.
He made me say Happy Provincial Budget Week, but the thing is, he was sincere when he wrote that.
He was excited when he wrote that.
He was more than excited.
Okay, so if I'm being completely honest, the budget is a good story. Like, it's a good story to cover, and because there's so many multiple stories, you know,
it all contained within it at once.
Yeah, contained within it. I don't like the budget lockup. Get your finger on the buzzer there. It's horse
Dan, tell me how you really feel.
Yeah, no. But it's all like, it's, you know, in Manitoba, we do a very, 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 very traditional budget lockup where you got to sign 14 forms and they take your cell phone. And
they put you in like a dark room, and then they pull you out only the second that it's released.
No,
they give you a copy of it quietly in a little cubicle.
So the budget isn't officially tabled until just after 3 p.m. in the Manitoba legislature. We get to go in as early as 10 a.m. and see the budget documents on an embargo basis, and then we get access to experts from Manitoba Finance who can explain, because, you know, it's pretty complex. It's all the other stuff. Like, you know, if you want to go to the bathroom, they have to escort you to the bathroom.
And they take away your phone?
They take away your phone. And then they also, this is my most hilarious part. So everybody brings their laptops, of course, because you got to write while you're in there. But they pay a guy from IT, you know, building IT, to stand where we go in. And he demands to see your laptop. And so that you can show him you've turned off the Wi-Fi. You've turned off, yeah. So, and that's the whole thing. Could you open up your laptop and show us that you're on, like, airplane mode or whatever? And it's like, and I always do the same thing. Like, I do it. I kind of roll my eyes. I do it. And then he goes, oh, okay, that's great. And when I close up my laptop, I go, and I'll try to resist the temptation to turn it back on once I'm inside.
I'm surprised they don't have one of those guys. You know, those guys like with the cologne and the napkins or whatever in the bathroom that just keep an eye on you. Just keep an eye to make sure you're not up to dubious stuff. The bathroom attendant.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, you know, the whole point is like they escort you to the bathroom, but they don't come in. Like, respect. Like, you know, well done. But they don't come in, but so they stand outside the bathroom. And so, I mean, seriously, like, if I wanted to call my stockbroker, I guess I could stash a burner in the like, it's just so stupid.
If you're in there for longer than 3 minutes, do you get the, is everything okay in there?
Yeah, no.
Do they give lunch? That's really what I want to know.
Because
you're stuck in there for 5 hours.
Yeah, no, we get snacks. Somebody thought to bring a box of unused like mini chocolate bars from Halloween. Okay, so that was cool. And you get coffee and soft drinks.
Forgive me. What would a used box of chocolate bars from Halloween look like?
Leave it to Adam.
Yeah.
So big time in Manitoba, budget 2024, the first of a canoe-led government. But
I have a nickname for this budget.
Oh, I'm ready.
Yeah. So I call this the everybody gets something they wanted, but nobody got everything they wanted.
Oh, well, that's isn't that a typical first budget? Or maybe that's almost like a pre-election kind of budget.
Yeah, a little bit. My main concern is I don't think it fits on a T-shirt, which I wanted.
It's a long T-shirt. It would be a sweater.
Yeah, the first part on the front and then, like.
It's written down budget, both sleeves.
Budget 2425. Everybody got something, ... And then on the back, ... But nobody got everything.
Well, those will be now on sale on our web store. Do we even have a web store? Okay, so, but, you know, the story that was alongside the budget and came out just after is that Manitoba is indicating, signaling, telling the federal government that they want out of carbon pricing.
Yeah.
Because they say, Manitoba says they're on track to be net zero, mostly due to Manitoba Hydro. You've done so much work on this.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on Manitoba? Basically, you know, kind of sides, almost like a, like the rest of the country saying axe the tax, not so much, but saying we're on our own here.
Yeah. Okay. So first off, Manitoba is one of the provinces in the country that did not bring in its own carbon tax. So as a result, it has what they call the federal backstop. So that is a federal carbon tax on fossil fuels, and it went up as of April 1st. And, you know, it is sort of the most inflammatory topic of debate in the federal political debate right now. The conservatives and leader Pierre Poilievre are, you know, they have they've basically come in with a bumper crop of on the rage farming on this thing. And really, like, without making much sense at all. And claiming that, you know, basically the carbon tax is responsible for everything,
yeah, including every problem in the country.
Yeah. Does your knee hurt? Yeah. That's the carbon tax right there. So, former Premier Brian Pallister promised to bring in a Manitoba carbon tax and then didn't bring in a Manitoba carbon tax. And then, this is kind of ironic considering the timing of other events. Then he met with, Prime Minister Trudeau. And Trudeau made kind of a snarky comment about how other conservative premiers in the country could learn a lot from Brian Pallister and his willingness to work with the federal government. Well, there's one thing you do not accuse Brian Pallister of, and that's being cooperative with anybody. Like, that is it. That was a slap in the face.
That was really the beginning of the end.
Yeah. Right there. So anyway, so he basically came out and said, "Yep, we're not doing our own carbon tax." And then he said, but we don't think the feds should impose a carbon tax here because we have so much clean energy here and all the other stuff that we're doing, like we'll get to net zero and we don't need to tax carbon at the pump and, or fossil fuels at the pump. And it is funny now that was almost word for word.
Almost exactly what Wab Kanu said. You know, I was on another show. Just a week ago, and I said,
"I bet you they pay better.
They pay a little bit better.
There are other shows.
Do they other shows?
They pay."
I made a comment that one of the biggest problems with carbon pricing is that it might not be the most effective strategy. It's an effective strategy, and I think that there's lots of research to prove that. But it may not be the most effective strategy because what it needs to be, and there's a kind of a hole in that carbon pricing argument in terms of people making, like Daniel Smith talking about sustainable energy, but never really defining what that is. But this is proof. Wab Kanu is illustrating exactly my point in that he is genuinely putting forth the argument that Manitoba is pursuing other means. And one of his main means is to take it off the everyday consumer. He was actually using terms like blue collar, protect the blue collar worker.
Yeah.
And we need to put it more onto large scale projects, programs, initiatives that try to move transit towards electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that's interesting because Manitoba's not arguing against the axe the tax movement, but is almost sidestepping it by saying that we're going to try other means and see how that works.
Yeah, I mean, listen, carbon pricing at the consumer level is the most cost-effective way of curbing fossil fuel consumption. It just is. And but you got to have everybody on the same page. So Prime Minister Trudeau failed to get anything even approaching a consensus, like everybody off doing their own thing. So that was mistake number one. And so,
arguably, I don't know if anyone would ever come on board anyways. I mean, well, you have this sort of right-wing premiership across the country.
In British Columbia, they have their own carbon tax. It's higher than the federal carbon tax. And they just increased theirs on April 1st. And I don't remember anybody, you know, blocking, you know, the bridge, the Lionsgate Bridge, you know, to protest. Because, you know, there, I think the difference is, I think people feel that they a better connection between the revenues raised by carbon pricing and things that help them burn less fossil fuels. Now, we get ours back in rebates. We get...
And that was the main thing that Wob was being asked, or Premier Canoe was being asked, is do you think that Manitobans will care about the rebate? And I think he's probably right in that I don't think most Canadians think about that rebate. They don't see it as something that's a critical part of their lives. They probably see the $15 at the pump from the gas tax.
15 cents.
15, well, I mean, if you fill up your tank, you know.
Not everybody drives a big honker like you.
Seriously. Well, they see the couple of bucks at the pump. Yeah. As being more impactful than even a rebate check through the mail or something direct deposit.
Here's the thing about rebates. I wrote about this recently, that really the vast majority, like more than 80% of everybody living in a province that's paying the federal carbon tax backstop gets a rebate. But public opinion polls, when you ask people, are you getting a rebate? Opinion polls in those provinces show that less than 50% of people believe they're getting the rebate.
Or even know about it.
Yeah. So I think that's another problem. Listen, it's gotten to the point where the unanswered question in federal politics is, do people oppose the carbon tax because it's a bad idea and Trudeau did a bad idea in selling it? Or do they oppose the carbon tax because it's Trudeau's idea and they've already decided that they don't like Trudeau? So, you know,
I would posit there might be a third option, which would be that they just do not have a robust understanding of what's at play, you know, and they think it's a bad idea because they don't know whether or not there are any other justifiably good, bad, or other alternatives.
I would personally give up my rebates if the government paid for half or three quarters of the cost for me to put a solar panel array on my house, which thankfully has a south-facing slope, and which is bombarded with sunlight now that they cut down one of the elm trees on the boulevard. Anyways, like, I could be selling electricity back to the grid.
We've got a plan. Maybe that's sponsorship.
Yeah.
Well, you have had you came out after budget lockdown. We're able to organize a sit-down with Manitoba Finance Minister Adrian Sala. But let's just highlight a couple parts of the budget that both maybe you touched upon or that you've touched upon in your interview with him. But I think a lot of people were expecting a consumption site and the funding of a consumption site. That's a really big step for the province, especially considering the previous government's commitment to, or lack thereof, to safe consumption. Hundreds of millions of dollars being put towards the building of ERs, particularly in Eriksdale, Victoria General. And then, of course, this hundreds of millions of dollars to bring people back into the healthcare system. The plan is to 1,000 new healthcare workers this year. Where are they going to come from?
Well, that, you know, I don't want to give away all the really great stuff from the interview, but I mean, it's a huge challenge. And, you know, there is a very good chance that, you know, governments that make definitive pledges during elections and then somehow, get elected, you know, it can be an albatross. So, you know, I do discuss with Minister Sala, you know, the 1999 NDP government and their pledge to end hallway medicine. And it turned out it was a stupid pledge, because even though there were too many people languishing on gurneys in ER hallways because there weren't any beds to admit them to. The fact is that there's no reasonable way or reason to eliminate all gurneys in ER hallways, because some people, they're sick and they need to be monitored and observed, but they're not sick enough to be admitted, and you don't want it, them taking up a bed. Yeah,
you don't want to make so, a promise yeah. that's impossible.
Yeah. So anyway, untenable. Yeah. So, you know, the Dewar government, Gary Dewar government, basically made huge progress, but essentially failed. Like history will show, they failed on their pledge to end hallway medicine. So hiring 1,000, and then Premier Wab Kanu came out and said, oh yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if we got more than 1,000. And I sort of imagine, you know, ministers of health and finance and whatever going, whoa.
Well, just the
it's
idea
gonna be
of
really, really hard.
Alone.
Really, mean, really hard.
100 doctors alone, I don't even know. Like the infrastructure at the University of Manitoba has the ability to pump out those kinds of healthcare workers so quickly,
yeah.
Within a year, for certainly almost impossible. But I mean, the reality is that they've made serious investments. They're saying every new dollar that comes into Manitoba is going towards healthcare. That's the proof will be, I suppose, in the bean counting as of next year from now. And but this budget, I think, as you mentioned, gave everybody a little bit of something. And I think that's going to be the strategy of this government going forward, to try to keep the momentum, or what Wab Kanu has called hope, a sort of a culture change. I'm actually wondering if all of this constant grinding against the previous government, like when is that going to stop?
Well, you know, the legacy, the fiscal legacy of the previous government is it will take, like, you know, a generation in parliamentary democracy is 4 years, right? So it's from election to election. I think it's going to take more than 4 years to deal with, you know, some of the problems that were created by the previous government. Massive underfunding of infrastructure. We are going to see major pieces of infrastructure fail. We've seen the Arlington Bridge already closed and no plan to replace it. We've seen, you know, you can sort of, you know, the drive test, right? You know, about the way Winnipeg roads.
Oh, they're crazy right there.
Yeah. But I mean, in Winnipeg, they've been spending record amounts of money. But outside the province is where you really, really start to notice huge tracts of provincial highway that are in bad shape. And then there's healthcare, where, you know, the new government renewed contracts with surgical and diagnostic providers outside Manitoba, because there's no immediate prospect of meeting the demand inside Manitoba. So the biggest concern that I have is that, you know, Brian Pallister and then Heather Stenson and the Tories starved the healthcare system, pissed off a lot of healthcare professionals, drove them out, like out of the province and out of the profession, nurses, hundreds of nurses going to work in the private sector. And they did that at a time, now at a time where every province, every jurisdiction in the world is desperate for doctors and nurses.
Yeah,
so it's not a matter of how sincere our intentions are. It's how big is the market? You know, and I don't know. I don't know.
Like, I don't know how quick the needle can be moved on healthcare. The last sort of, I guess, footnote is that we're looking at a deficit of below half of what the previous deficit was, which arguably still could be from some pandemic.
From about impacts. 1.9 billion down to just under 800 million.
Yeah. That's an interesting trend of, I think people would still generally understand, if you're rebuilding from a crumbling infrastructure, from a austerity-based government in the past, that you'd see maybe a higher deficit. But I think they've got a plan, and their big plan is to change, overhaul the housing tax, school taxes, to try to invest and try to get people who have bigger houses, larger houses, suburban houses, to pay a little bit more on their property tax.
Yeah.
And that I think is a political hot potato that may or may not come and impact them.
You know, what they did on taxation was, and I'm not talking about the merits of tax increases or tax cuts. I'm just saying as a political strategy, it was kind of elegant. So what they did is they tweaked two important tax cuts that the Tories brought in. One was the 50% of property taxes rebated by check, and then the other one was a fairly significant increase in the basic personal amount. So that's the amount of money that everybody gets to earn without paying any taxes. And so what they did is they flat capped the property tax rebate. So now if you own a huge and expensive home, like Nigan, and
hardly.
Well, you got to have somewhere to park your huge truck. So anyway,
are rumors and innuendos.
Yeah, okay. Really. We'll be doing a live remote from Nagan's driveway next week. But there were like even I think the Brian Pallister owned like a $4 or $5 million home, maybe $3 million home on Wellington Crescent.
With 24-hour security.
Yeah, with 24-hour security. And was getting like a $12,000 income tax rebate or a property tax rebate. Well, so he'll only get $1,500 flat. And so it is keeping the rebate, but it's ensuring that people with more modest homes who pay less in taxes, but they get more of a full benefit of the $1,500. So there'll be a lot of people who qualify for the $1,500 that really, really need it. On the idea that people that were getting $12,000 back probably don't really, really need the second one was the basic personal exemption. So we've become the first province in the country to fully claw back the basic personal amount from high income earners. So at $200,000 net income, they start to claw back the basic personal amount is a little over $16,000. So they start to claw it back, and then by the time you hit $400,000, you have to pay the lowest income bracket tax on your first $16,000. So you will be paying. It works out to be at maximum about $1,700 additional taxes, provincial income taxes. It's a clever way. Both of them are together a clever way of taxing higher net income individuals.
That's what I mean when I said.
Yeah.
I wonder when people will figure it out. Other than listening to our podcast and having you. And I will tell you, I tease you a lot. First of all, I just realized you've never been to my house. But anyways.
What the hell?
I've been to your house many times. Yeah. I don't think you've ever been to my house. But anyways, I tease you a lot about knowing so much about the budget. But it is pretty remarkable, the intricacies. And it really is proof that your multiple thousands of decades work in the media has really brought you to a state of guru when it comes to thinking about budgets and understanding all the intricacies. It is pretty impressive.
As the representative of the layman sitting here, for me, it's brilliant that you, as a published journalist, are somebody who's a nerd about this stuff and uses that power to try and explain it to people in a way they understand. So thank you for providing that public service. Yeah.
My wife doesn't even kick me under the table anymore when I try to explain. Like,
you must be over the breakfast.
I've actually walked through the Winnipeg Aqueduct and blah, blah, blah.
Let's get to your visit with Manitoba Minister of Finance, Adrian Sala. His first budget. They were pretty excited, and I'm sure you were pretty excited to do this interview.
Yep, here we go. Feature interview with Finance Minister Adrian Sala. The 2024-25 provincial budget is literally, figuratively, the ink isn't quite dry on it. We're lucky enough to have Finance Minister Adrian Sala here to discuss all the things we don't know yet about the budget. Mm-hmm. I decided that I'm going to actually ask you to identify things in the budget that we haven't reported on yet that might be worth noting for a variety of reasons. Before we get to that fascinating question, thanks for being here.
It's so great to be with you. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Thanks for having me.
Well, then you automatically get invited back just for saying that. So it's well played.
This is a good start.
So there's a lot of attention on healthcare in the budget. There's a lot of attention on education and connected to education property taxes, things like that. So I will ask you right off the bat, the highlights, the things that you wanted us to talk about, let's talk about those things for a sec. And then let's also talk about things that are involve tougher decisions. Because, you know, giving more money to healthcare, giving more money to education, that's probably wasn't the toughest decision you had to make in this budget. So we'll move on after that to where it got harder. But healthcare, your main narrative is that this budget does deliver on the main promise from the election campaign, which is to make healthcare the number one priority.
That's right. Yeah, no, we've talked about this for some time, and clearly in the election, we made very firm commitments around fixing healthcare and making Manitoba more affordable. And I think this budget delivers on that commitment. $1 billion for healthcare. We've committed to 1,000 new healthcare workers, 600 healthcare aides, 100 new doctors, 210 nurses, and 90 paramedics. And we know that these are the things that Manitobans wanted to see from their new government, and we're delivering on that.
So coming into the budget, third quarter report confirmed a nearly $2 billion budget deficit from the year before. So this budget, the forecast deficit at the end of this fiscal year is just under $800 million, which is a massive improvement. But so if you're going to increase support to core programs like healthcare and education, there are other programs, other areas of government that have to suffer a little bit. So where did you have to tighten the belt a little bit to sort of make the budget work?
Well, I'd say coming into government, we knew the depth of cuts that we've seen to healthcare, to education, to infrastructure, frankly, across many areas of government coming in. But when we got here, it became clear that the impacts of those cuts were severe and that there was something of, I'd say, a deficit overall that had been created, not just, of course, on the operations side, but more realistically in terms of where government was in almost every area. And so that's challenging in that we got in and we could really see finally, once we were able to open the books, the scope of impact that the last government had in setting services back for Manitobans. And so we made commitments around fixing healthcare and ensuring Manitobans can access healthcare that they need, that they deserve. We made commitments around improving affordability, but at the same time, we saw this, you know, this huge, really these other deficits that had been created that maybe weren't as visible, that needed to be responded to. That, you know, forced us to engage in dialogue about where do we place our focus, and that required a lot of decisions. We see how far we've been set back as a province as a result of those 7 years. And so, you know, we had to decide where we were going to place our focus, of course. And I think what we've done here is we've struck a good balance in ensuring that we move in repairing a lot of the damage that had been created across multiple areas of government. But we ensured that we focused in those areas that we committed to delivering on, which are healthcare and affordability.
So what areas were you compelled, though, to tighten the belt? Because not every area of government, every budget line, every department can receive, you know, inflation plus one or whatever, you know, the metric would be. So where in the budget did you find that you could defensibly cut back a little bit, or at least, you know, hold the line a little bit? I've got a couple of examples I'm going to ask about, but I'm just wondering where your thought process took you to, what you were, and where you sort of said, well, in a perfect world, we'd love to give everybody more money for everything, but you can't. So where did you have to tighten the belt?
Look, I think Manitobans see gaps in a lot of areas in terms of services. I can say that, you know, we know there are needs across multiple areas, whether it was education or municipalities, that we really fell behind. I think about the impacts in our education system and what we saw there as a result of their failure to fund education adequately over many years. We had a lot of kids who were falling behind, who were coming to school hungry, when we knew that a little bit of food would help them to achieve better outcomes and help them to get ahead. Kids who weren't getting psych assessments for 2 years because divisions weren't funded adequately. It's tough looking at that situation and knowing that there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done and a huge amount of investment that needed to be made. But we had to do that in a good and fiscally responsible manner. And we made a clear commitment, as you probably have heard us repeat many times, that we are going to deliver a balanced budget at the end of our first mandate. So trying to make sure we balance the need to respond to all, again, of these sort of these invisible deficits while we started to move forward on our commitments was challenging overall. But again, I really think that this budget did the best job we could of that in starting that process of meaningfully moving ahead, not only on our commitments, but starting to repair the damage in a number of departments and areas that Manitobans really count on.
So is that to say that you didn't have to either freeze or cut funding to any area of the budget?
No, it's to say there were a lot of tough decisions. We had to make decisions to bring forward a responsible budget here.
Can you give me an example of a decision you personally found tough?
Well, one thing I'd say that I think has been, we've seen some discussion around recently is we saw that the last government talked about a lot of commitments around schools, for example. They'd made a number of commitments there that were unbudgeted.
This is the construction of new schools or replacement of schools.
Yeah. So a number of unbudgeted promises there for, you know, schools that perhaps are needed in our communities, but again, were imaginary in that they didn't have budget for, and got folks, people's emotions worked up about things that were coming that really they had no plan to pay for. And so we see those needs there. And, what we're going to do is, as we've heard from our education minister, when we make a commitment to build new schools, Manitobans can have confidence that that means we're actually going to build them. We're not just going to talk about it. And so, that's an example of an area where we see need, but again, we have to progress responsibly with our eye on that prize, which is making sure we deliver on that commitment. Not because delivering a balanced budget is in itself sort of something that will deliver on the needs of Manitobans. It's because in order to continue to do the work of making good investments, we have to keep that balance, which is ensuring we manage those funds very responsibly so we can keep credit rating agencies happy, we can keep our cost of capital as low as possible so we can keep delivering the things that Manitobans count on.
Similar scenario with long-term care. There was a lot of promises, some promises that went back, in fact, to the previous NDP government to build in communities outside Winnipeg. It appears some of those projects have been delayed again so that you can kind of deal with what you need to deal with now. So long-term care is sort of in the same boat as some of those school projects.
I think so. Like, we see those needs. And again, this isn't to say that these projects aren't going to happen. It's to say we're going to make them happen when we are able to do that. And so identifying where those priorities are and making sure that we manage these funds responsibly is critical. And we were very happy to announce the Lac-Da-Bonnie PCH a couple of weeks ago.
We think
that's going to help out folks in that community in a big way.
So here's one. I mean, it wasn't a budget cut, and it certainly was an improvement over what the former PC government was doing. But I thought the 2% for municipalities was lean based on two things. Number one is because they went 6 years with no increases to funding. And also because Mayor Scott Gillingham was not the only municipal leader to say, we were kind of expecting a little bit more, like after having conversations with the province. And for the uninitiated in the audience, there is this weird disconnect between the provincial fiscal year and municipal budgets, which are on a calendar year. So the municipalities have to deliver their operating budgets at the first of the year without knowing the exact dollars and cents. And this is one of those questions for information, but can the province not get into a situation of doing what the federal government does? The federal government, January 1st, tells you what you're getting in terms of equalization. They don't make you wait until the budget. Is there some reason why you can't do that for municipalities? Tell them what they're getting?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great things about this budget is that we are responding to that, because for years they had freezes To their funding, and there was an outright funding freeze for municipalities. But what this budget does is it does give them clarity on what funding they can expect in the future. So they don't have to wait and guess, because this budget clearly states a 2% per year increase until the end of our first mandate. So they're not needing to do exactly what you just outlined there, which is genuinely, I could see a huge challenge for for leaders within our municipal communities.
I mean, I do think some of the municipal leaders sounded a little like, you know, hostages that had been, you know, taken for a long time, who were kind of happy to have a couple of extra hours of outside time. Like, nobody was going to say that's bad, but I mean, 2% in the with current economic conditions, that is still pretty lean. Does that qualify as a hard decision, that you couldn't give them more of a catch-up bump this year?
Look, you know, we're making tough decisions. We know municipalities have to make tough decisions. 8% over a mandate is a significant increase, we think. $52 million increase this year as a function of that 2% increase. This is going to go a long ways. We know that there's always more to do, and we know that I'm sure more funds are something that, as you've outlined, folks were looking to see. But we are again proceeding on the basis that we want to make sure that we're balancing all of our needs right now as a province. This is great news, I think, for municipalities, and will help them to deliver on the services that folks across Manitoba are looking to them to deliver on.
Let's talk a bit about healthcare funding. As a self-described budget nerd, I'm always interested in the way government expenditures evolve from budget to update to public accounts. So again, for the uninitiated, we won't really know the exact size of the deficit and what the government spent and what the revenues were coming in until August and September of this year, when we get the public accounts for the previous fiscal year. In healthcare funding, and nobody seemed to tweak too much on this, because the government's narrative was that it was nearly $1 billion increase in funding. That's from budget to budget. When you look at it from actual to budget, so the actual being how much money was actually spent to the end of the third quarter, it's really, there's only a very, very small increase in funding from what was actually going to be spent in the 22-23 or the 23-24 fiscal year. So I want you to explain to people why you think it's more important that we go from budget to budget, because budget to budget doesn't really reflect the cost of delivering healthcare last year, does it?
Well, what we did see in 23-24, and which just wrapped, of course, was some concerns with over expenditures in some of our health regions. You will know that we did announce that we're moving forward with audits for some of those health regions to get a clear sense of what happened there and what was driving those over expenditures. There were also a number of unplanned collective bargaining agreements that were signed over the last year that contributed to that as well. We feel that the budget we've brought forward, which again is $1 billion in additional healthcare spending, reflects the true needs for the system over the next year to the best of our ability, is a transparent sort of clear-eyed attempt at ensuring we have all the funds we need to deliver on the commitments we've brought forward. And I think that's what distinguishes what we've brought forward this year as a healthcare budget versus what Manitobans saw last year.
Sure.
So that, you know, the issue you're raising, which I accept, is certainly a concern. But what we can say is this budget accounts for what we think are going to be the realistic costs this year. And while we move forward this year, we're going to be paying very close attention to healthcare expenditures. We're going to be seeing what kind of improvements we can make in controlling those expenditures to make sure that we're delivering the best value possible for Manitobans and delivering that healthcare.
So healthcare spending, if you go actual to 2024-25 budget, it's like a less than 1% increase. And again, the reason I'm going to harp on this a little bit is because we hammered the previous government for the exact same analysis. So these are the same metrics we used when we started to see that the government was underspending on what their budgeted amounts, and then adding very, very little to the what they actually spent. For your government, like for your government to claim the $1 billion increase, you're going to have to account for a significant amount of waste within what was actually spent last year. Like that's like waste that's now going to be diverted to frontline services. So has, and I know there are audits coming, but if you had to ballpark it, you know, just so people know the numbers. So the PC government budgeted $7.2 billion. At the end of the third quarter, we had recorded $8.1 billion of actual spending. That number, I'm going to go way out on a limb and say it's going to get a little bit bigger by the time the public accounts come out. And some of that spending would have actually been your spending, right? Like there, mm-hmm. there would have been interim or emergency spending that needed to be done to do certain things. So we're talking nearly $1 billion worth of unbudgeted spending. How much of that is actually just waste or bad management, bad performance of the system?
Look, we know we have incredible people working in our healthcare system in Manitoba, people who want to do well. We do, however, at the same time, see that there are some real concerns with budgeting. Mm-hmm. And with cost controls in some of those health regions. That's why we're moving forward with these audits. And again, it's not an audit for audit's sake. It's to ensure that we can get clarity over where are those opportunities that you're identifying. Right. And we need some support in getting the best clarity possible on where those opportunities are, with the goal on ensuring that we create better value with our spending. Because what we've seen over the last many years, and I know my colleague, the Minister of Health, Minister Asaguara, speaks to this, is that we're seeing costs of healthcare go up, but we're not seeing the outcomes necessarily get better. Mm-hmm. So we know we can do better. We know that it's important that we dig into this question, and that's exactly what we're doing, and that work's being led by our incredible Minister of Health.
So, I want to come to, I haven't done the word bubble. Like I was going to do a word bubble from the news conference, from recording the news conference. But 1,000 new healthcare workers had to be, at least tied for the biggest bubble. It was mentioned a lot yesterday. So, in an analysis published today in the Winnipeg Free Press, there was a suggestion made that the 1,000 new healthcare workers could become this government's version of ending hallway medicine. Hmm. 1999, Gary Doer and NDP government is elected. Number one pledge, end hallway medicine. Long story short, any hallway medicine is really kind of impractical because there's a lot of people that come into the ER that need to be kept for observation for a variety of reasons who don't need to be admitted to hospital. Mm-hmm. So they need to be kept somewhere. So there were huge strides in improving the situation, but could never claim success because they didn't end mm-hmm. hallway medicine. So how much risk is there in not hitting 1,000? And I will remind you that the premier actually suggested that you would likely exceed 1,000. So there's a big political risk reward on that number now, is there not?
If there is risk, it's a risk we have to take, because we know that one of the biggest challenges facing our healthcare system and ultimately Manitobans being able to access the quality of care that they need and deserve is responding to these healthcare staffing challenges and, frankly, the crisis we have in our system. I think that, look, this work is going to proceed and start with a foundation of culture change. We've seen already our premier and our minister of health listening. And that's something that hasn't happened for some time. And I'll share that, in my conversations, when I speak with healthcare workers and folks who are currently in our hospitals, who've seen our premier and our minister of health in those facilities, have expressed just such incredible welcomeness and such mm-hmm. Excitement about the idea that leaders like Minister Asaguara are there and are listening, and they're showing up to shift changes, the nursing shift changes, and hearing what happened last night, what's happening this morning. And instead of, looking at their watch and saying, oh, we got to go as soon as the tough conversations start happening, they're staying there and listening and actually working to understand mm-hmm. What's happening on the ground. I think that is a wonderful expression and signal of the change that healthcare workers are seeing here in Manitoba with our new government. from it. And it's about listening. It's about really understanding that those folks on the ground know better than anyone else mm-hmm. about the opportunities we have to make healthcare better for Manitobans. So that culture change sort of sets a ground floor. But then from there, there's actual, some really great initiatives that we're bringing forward to help deliver on that 1,000 worker commitment. And if I could just briefly summarize those, there's the Healthcare Workforce Office, which has been announced as part of this budget. One of the issues we had prior is that there was no central coordinating body to allow us to make good on all these opportunities we have to use all these skilled workers in Manitoba, whether they're Manitobans themselves from here or whether they're new Canadians with healthcare skills that we can put to work. So this office will help to coordinate that and will help to drive, I think, getting folks with those skills into the healthcare system. So that's a big part of it. The other thing I think that's important to highlight here is we've got a number of folks within programs across the province that are going to be graduating over the next couple of years. We want those folks to stay in Manitoba because right now we know that we're developing doctors, we're developing folks, and they're sometimes not deciding to stay within our province. Every one of those graduates from whether it's from medical programs, nursing programs, are going to receive a letter from the Premier and from the Minister of Health inviting them, first of all, congratulating them on their success, but inviting them to work and to contribute to our healthcare system. I think that's an amazing first signal about, how things have changed, that it's a very different environment where you have leadership that not only respects you, but recognizes the value you provide. So in addition to that, we're making investments in a doctor recruitment fund. We're reinvesting in a rural doctor recruitment fund that the last government cut. We're expanding medical residencies by 38%. There's investments in a nursing float pool. All these things mm-hmm. together are really, I think, showing that this is a full court press, right? We know that this is so important, not only on recruitment, but also on retention. And I think that the work that's being done by, and I'll say this, mm-hmm. our Minister of Health has a background in healthcare. They were a psych nurse for years. They get it. They really understand the system, mm-hmm. and we're fortunate for that. And they're digging in and doing the work. And I think, you know, back to your original question, I'm confident that we're going to deliver on that. And hopefully, as the Premier said, we're going to exceed it.
Yeah, because I think the it is somewhat unfair that the NDP government, Gary Doer's NDP government, didn't get credit for moving a lot of people out of hallways, but it got to the point where they had reports that showed progress, but they wouldn't release them because it fell well short of ending hallway medicine. I think the one that I think to me is the most difficult in that mix of 1,000 new healthcare workers is nurses. That's the largest component. As a result, just as a statement of fact, you have more people retiring, more people going, deciding to work in the private sector. So some of this, these job offers going to graduating students, some of that can be timed with the completion of the program. Mm-hmm. So we can, sort of see what's happening there. But I mean, everybody seems to know that getting nurses back from the private sector into the public sector is the big one. Do you have any evidence that you've had any success just sounding different notes, like listening more, and responding at least initially more to the concerns of nurses? Is there any evidence that nurses are returning from private nursing agencies?
I mean, we're hearing this from nurses when we speak with them about their sense of how things have changed. Yeah. And I think that going back to my comments around the culture change and the focus on respecting healthcare workers, I think that message is getting out there. And we are hearing that folks, I think, are willing to start coming back as a result of that if they'd left the system and seeing the real change that has been brought forward here by our minister and by our team here.
Taxes. Okay, so I had a lot of fun on Budget Day writing about this. I won't go into all of the metaphor abuse that I got involved in. But just to say that it's kind of doesn't matter what political stripe, like reversing a tax cut from a previous government, you can do it, but it's at your own risk. Like it, generally speaking, is considered to be a trick too far for a new government coming in. You guys didn't reverse any of the tax cuts, but you changed some of them significantly. And so the elevator pitch, pricey version of what you did was you actually created high individual wealth surtaxes. Like you created charges on people that make a lot of money, but you did it really by making them ineligible to receive a benefit or a full benefit from some of the tax cuts that the previous government put in. Is that a completely unfair way of describing it?
Look, the focus of those revenue changes were on improving affordability for Manitobans. One of the things that I'm really excited about is that this budget and some of the revenue measures that we brought in, like the $1,500 homeowner affordability credit, are going to really put hundreds of dollars in the pockets of lower income Manitobans, people who need it. You know, we've heard the premier say this, and I've been saying this. This is more help for the people who need it most. And we know that as a function of that credit and that change that we've made, there are a lot of Manitobans who are no longer even going to be paying school taxes. And those are people who really need that help. We know that prices have been higher for families for years now due to higher inflation. We see the impacts of interest rates going up. New, you know, homeowners that, or folks who are looking to get into homeownership, this can be a game changer for them. And so, you know, I think these changes do that important work. They also reflect, the reality of what we found when we got in here. There were particular numbers and assumptions that had been made based on what the PCs had put into their budget for 23-24, that when we got in, it was clear were inaccurate, or at least things had been, the budget that they'd run on had been wildly inaccurate and was really, they'd overrun it. And so when we got in and we saw that, you know, we had to make sure that we made responsible decisions, and we had to ensure we focused on our commitments, improving affordability, while responding to the reality of the hand that we were dealt.
The basic personal exemption clawback, which your officials have told me we're the first province in the country to fully claw that back. I'm wondering if you, it may be too early because the news just broke, but do you expect that to be of interest to other finance ministers in the country? It is kind of a, detractors will call it insidious. You know, others might refer to it as kind of elegant. But again, like it's a way of getting people at the very, very higher end of the income ladder to pay more taxes by taking away the basic personal exemption. I got to kind of wonder why it wasn't done before, because it does seem to be such a simple, you know, and elegant solution. But was that an idea that you guys had during the campaign, or is it something that, how did you percolate that idea?
You know, again, in terms of that decision and all of the decisions that were made in developing this budget, it was about, you know, first of all, how do we improve, focus on the priorities of Manitobans, healthcare, affordability. Those investments required us to look around and figure out how we can do that in the best way possible. Those decisions were made in an environment and in a context where, again, we came in and we found a $1.6 billion deficit. The scope of that fiscal challenge, you know, drove those decisions, and ultimately, we had to make sure we adjust for that reality that we were left with.
The one you didn't change, was the sort of catch-up bracket bumps that the Tories introduced. So a $10,000 increase to the lowest income bracket and a $20,000 increase to the second bracket. So, you know, again, if you live within those brackets, you're probably going to see a significant improvement. But you're also, like, that is really a benefit that's also available to people at the very highest end. Mm-hmm. So I know you've called it a middle-class tax cut. But there's, you know, I would argue there really isn't anything such. When you move brackets for everybody, including upper income class. Mm-hmm. Why leave that one the way it is? Like, why not tweak the numbers a little bit again to make it less impactful on the treasury? Or once you're dealing with brackets, I'm not sure like, I guess you could have focused everything on the lowest bracket, but you'd still be providing a benefit for all tax filers. So, but why leave? Because that's way, way above, you know, the normal inflationary indexing.
Well, you know, I'd start by saying that we made a commitment to bring those bracket changes in. And I think Manitobans heard us, made that commitment loud and clear. We wanted to honor that. Look, those bracket changes were also a decision that we actively had to make that was in our hands entirely, and that we decided to follow through on that and follow through on that commitment. Those reductions in costs are going to go a long ways for folks, you know, throughout lower and middle income categories. And frankly, I do believe this honestly, that we have an issue in terms of ensuring we are competitive with neighboring jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. We're in a, you know, a pan-Canadian fight for the same workers as other jurisdictions are looking for when it comes to nurses, skilled labor. And I do genuinely believe that, you know, those are the rates that are on the sandwich board when somebody looks at a province and decides whether or not they're going to, mm-hmm. they're going to make that move. And I do think that it is beyond simply the affordability considerations,
right.
an important concern from a competitiveness perspective, ensuring that we can be an attractive place, for those workers that we need, frankly, to come to mm-hmm. Manitoba and to come contribute to the important work that we need to do. So I think from, you know, that perspective and from an affordability perspective, we think it was the right move, to ensure that we could move folks ahead, in terms of affordability and get the workers we need to do the important jobs that need to be done.
Right. I don't know. I have to study this more to know if what I'm saying is actually correct in any regard. But I did kind of see, like, if I was an individual with a net income $300,000-$500,000 a year, I mean, we have fewer of those people than other provinces, but this is one of the best provinces to live in and make a whack ton of money. In fact, our highest rate is much lower than it is in provinces like, well, BC and Ontario are the two where they really kick in much higher rates, the higher you go up in the income. Is that, that seems to be a hard, marketing message for government to sell. Hey, come and make a ton of money in Manitoba and pay 4, 5, 6% less in an effective tax rate on that highest sum of money. But it is kind of weird, right? That, like, for the people who are on the E-team, the C-suite team at Investors Group and Canada Life, they've actually got a pretty good deal here. Is there, is that, am I not paying attention?
Well, you know, the measures we brought forward were focused on helping lower and middle income Manitobans. In terms of our competitiveness at those higher levels and the sort of the tax burden carried by folks at those very, very highest levels, I think that that's, there's nothing wrong with folks being able to do well. And,
yeah.
you know, we, I think, stand to benefit from being a place where people feel they can move and see real mobility opportunities.
Right.
That's good. That has to be balanced, though, with ensuring that, of course, we have what we need to deliver on the services we need. And I think that what we brought forward is showing that we're able to, as a new government, bring in changes that will improve affordability, make life better for Manitobans, while we balance the books and deliver on the priorities that they sent us here to deliver on.
So one of the crueler aspects of, you know, having to endure debate and media coverage of a budget immediately forthcoming in the budget is that you guys hold back a lot of details so that you don't run out of things to announce. You know, and this is, every government does this, right? Like, there are, people are asking questions about, well, what does this mean and what's on this budget line? And it's like, stay tuned is kind of the message. Okay. So in today's Free Press, there was an article where opposition critics and some people outside of the political system were criticizing the government for cutbacks in the justice portfolio. And they mentioned three or four areas where funding was reduced or cut completely: community corrections, Manitoba Criminal Intelligence Center, the Crime Prevention Office, and the Families Resolution Service. The premier's response was that there was actually $20 million increase. Okay, so I'm going to go out on one of those well-informed limbs that I like to go out every once in a while, and suggest that you guys are actually swapping out some old programs and bringing in new programs. And, you know, and I understand if you're not ready to completely announce some of these things, but there was references to linking youth with supports, something I'm sure you have a deep personal interest in. Mm-hmm. A $20 million strategy for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Public safety strategy, as yet undefined. 25 new mental health workers, possibly to work in the ARC program or in some other way. Mm-hmm. But is that what's really going on here? And are you kind of enduring the criticism because you don't want to blow the news conference in a week, a month, 3 months?
I think just in terms of the comments around reductions in investments in some of those areas, one thing I think that, and I know my colleague, the Minister of Justice, spoke to this just yesterday, these are not real reductions of any kind. And the reason I say that is because we've effectively just re-baselined budgets where we had significant vacancies. So in some of those areas where you had, you know, 25, 30% vacancy rates, we've re-baselined those budgets.
You just eliminated those open positions.
Yeah, so it's not a make-believe budget, right? So we still have those vacancies which we need to fill.
Right.
So there are no real reductions there. That's a paper-based exercise that I think the opposition is going to do what they do and try to have fun with, but there are no real reductions there. Look, our government, our premier has been clear that we are a government that is going to be tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime. Mm-hmm. Manitoba's going to expect that we're going to continue to make the investments needed in justice. I know my colleague, the Minister of Justice, Minister Weeb, is leading that work. I think he's doing an incredible job of that. And there's some good investments in here for, as you said, public safety, $6.3 million in a public safety strategy yet to be fully articulated.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. There's dollars here for urban policing grants, I think $13 million. There's a First Nations and Inuit policing commitment there of about $8 million. And as you said, there's 25 mental health workers that are going to be there to help support, you know, folks who are struggling and are in difficult situations.
Working with police, I think, was the reference. Yeah.
Yeah. So look, these are not reductions. These are investments. We're increasing our investments and responding to these challenges. We know this is important. And again, I think my colleague is doing great work leading that and helping to ensure that we make smart investments in improving safety for Manitobans.
So the last thing I want to bring up is that, you know, in the lead up to the last election, the Progressive Conservatives were involved in a lot of big ticket announcements, one-off big ticket announcements. There's always, whenever there's a change in government, there are always these projects left hanging in the air where, you know, a premier went and did a news conference. And I don't think these are actually, because the gestation, like it takes a long time to pull these projects together. So the idea that they're unfunded isn't really the issue. Are there big one-off promises that the Tories made that aren't going to find their way into the new government's agenda?
The Tories made a lot of unbudgeted promises and promises that they did not have plans to pay for. That's not just, you know, partisanship here.
Can you give me an example of something?
Well, we've already identified some of them, right? Like the nine schools that they've identified. Like you said, there was a whole suite of different commitments that had been made that really just they had no plans to pay for. And, you know, I'll say again, under the last government, they kind of went hog wild with unplanned, unbudgeted expenditures and unplanned commitments and things that were really, really set to put our province in an even worse fiscal position than they left us. So, look, again, going back to, you know, something we touched on earlier, governing is about making, decisions, tough decisions sometimes about how we prioritize spending. There are so many spending pressures that our government faced when we got in. The books were way worse than we had been led to believe, than Manitobans had been led to believe. And we had to make decisions to prioritize spending where we know Manitobans wanted us to focus. I think, Dan, I really do feel confident about this, that Manitobans will, as they start to really dig into this budget, see that we've really focused where they wanted us to focus, and we're really working to fulfill the commitments that we made. And I'm confident that that's going to make Manitoba into a better place to live.
So you are asking people, though, and it's always the case, but maybe more so for the first budget from a new government, you're asking for some delayed gratification right now. You know, because there are, we haven't talked about, but there are a lot of policy issues that are partly budgetary issues, but also just partly policy, supervised consumption site, you know, restoration of the Victoria General Hospital ER. Mm-hmm. These are things like, I'm not sure it would be fair to say you've kicked the can down the road because it's going to take some time to do these things. Mm-hmm. But there are some important things promised during the election that aren't really going to show up until the next budget or even maybe the budget after that.
Well, I think that this budget shows huge progress on a significant number of our commitments, like the Vic ER, like the Eriksdale ER. We are making big progress, I think, in our first year here. And yes, we need to pace these things because government can't do everything at once. Again, going back to this question about balance, and I think this shows that.
Thank you very much for spending some time with us, and best of luck in QP because you're hitting there soon. And you know, it's what did Betty Davis say? You know, like, put your hard hats on because it's going to be a bumpy ride. So maybe that's the quote that we finish with. But anyways, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Interesting interview with Finance Minister Adrian Sala. I think that. You know, to me, some of the most interesting part came out of asking him, and I did have to ask him more than once, to identify those areas of the budget where they had to tighten their belt. Because, I mean, you know, budget day is all about highlighting where they're spending more money and making a bigger investment. And a couple of interesting comments. First of all, and this partly explains the challenge of covering budgets.
Yeah.
You can't, like, when you see that a budget line has gone down, you can't always assume that that means there's less money for programs. He said, and it does make sense, the government was, in some departments, had huge vacancy management numbers. So they had huge numbers of funded positions that were just never filled. So they've eliminated a lot of those, and that actually drops the baseline in a lot of
trimming,
areas.
Trimming around.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is just the... I think that they they're very pleased with themselves and how they've managed taxes.
You know, I'm glad like you're saying it.
Yeah, no. But it is, you know, Adrian is like, I mean, he is a very effective
communicator
for the government. He's very knowledgeable. I mean, I threw. Like not just budget questions, but departmental programming questions at him, and he didn't flinch. That's super important when you've got a guy who can do that. And but yeah, I think they feel really like what they've done. They kept the Tory tax cuts, kinda, but they tweaked them to make them more palatable for the NDP core. Yeah. So I don't know. Like, how do you think it's playing?
So far, I think that they've been able to navigate something pretty remarkable in that they've kept some of the major linchpins of the Pallister government, a government that they constantly were battling up against, but then brought in enough things to make this budget look absolutely fresh, including things like the landfill search. And I think there's enough big ticket new items there to kind of obscure the fact that they're recycling some old Pallister ideas.
Well, to me, the big challenge, and this is not just a challenge for this government, but a lot of the highest profile stuff that they promised to do, they have had to kick some of those cans down the road because they're just this year dealing with the nearly $2 billion deficit isn't the year to do it. So supervised consumption, that there's money for consultation, but no money to actually build anything this year. So that's going to be that project has been pushed down the pike a little bit. You know, the ER and the Mature Women's Health Center at Victoria Hospital, there's preliminary, like they can do some preliminary work, but the actual, and they said shovel in the ground before the end of the year. But, you know, and these are, to be fair, these aren't things that you can't just snap your fingers and open up a new ER. You can't, you know, the supervised consumption. If you pick a site and you don't do consultation, then you're doomed to fail. So
where that goes, and they're indicating that's downtown. I mean, we can probably all imagine whereabouts downtown, but where that goes is going to be very significant because there is some controversial research on supervised consumption sites that I and others have talked about in terms of where it goes and whether it increases some areas in the neighborhood, not in the actual site itself. It also obscures some really big things that the provinces had to pay out, like the huge issue around child welfare with Indigenous agencies, $530 million. Like, that hasn't dragged the government down. Arguably not the fault of this government, but a previous NDP government was the one who started that whole problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And they haven't, that really hasn't stuck. And the idea that that didn't slow anything down with this budget, I think, is very significant.
Yeah. You know, citizens are asked to demonstrate delayed gratification on a lot of issues, and that's always sort of the case. I personally found the willingness of this government, for example, this is an area where Minister Sala talks about how they had to tighten their belts. So the former Tory government promised, I think, 9 new schools, like a whack of new schools. And basically, you know, the Canoe government's come out and said, yeah, you know what, we're not going to be able to do that, at least not right now. Same thing with long-term care. They've had to put into stasis a couple of high-profile projects outside the city and just say, like, I'm sorry, the previous government promised it, but it wasn't funded, and we don't have the money for it right now. So the willingness to say those things and not avoid or dodge, that's a huge change from the Pallister era, where like every time we accuse his government of austerity, like, he flipped his lid, right? And denied that, you know, and every time they added a dollar to a budget line, it was the most money that they'd ever invested in.
Ever in history.
Yeah. So, I mean, that stuff is just so, you know, intellectually dishonest. And it's also, like, even though I wouldn't say journalists are necessarily the most complex people in the world, but we figured it out. I mean, if the press gallery figures it out, if they see through you, then it wasn't a very good strategy to begin with, I don't think so.
Well, the budget wasn't the only news this week. In other news, there's some feel-good stuff happening in the city. I don't know if you all got a chance to check it out, but if you do get a chance to check it out, Valor FC, our professional Canadian Premier League soccer team in the city. I was at a big gathering last night where they unveiled this season's new jerseys. There's an incredible jersey that they have honoring the Winnipeg Fury. They're going to honor them this season. They're going to wear them for some games. They're bringing out all the Fury players that won the championship way back in 1992. Oh, wow. And secondly, you know, a jersey that I designed, they're going to use that as the home design for this season. It's really beautiful. I worked with the team. I just came up with the concept of it. It has a sunflower, a traditional sunflower, an Indigenous sunflower to Manitoba. I don't know if you know, but Manitoba produces 90% of Canada's sunflowers, and that's where, you know, it's a traditional medicine for our people that helps with birth.
You didn't know about summary budgets, and I didn't know about sunflowers. So
we're even now. There's 4 really beautiful prairie crocuses, which are very important to Anishinaabe, Cree, Anisinew, and Dakota, Lakota, Nakota peoples. It's said that when a bison baby is born, that's where a prairie crocus sprouts up.
Wow.
And so it's also the first flower of spring. So as this is the springtime, this new jersey that came out for Valor FC, encourage everybody to check it out. And they're available now for sale.
Okay. So through the Valor FC website?
And at the Bomber store at the stadium, they have the new season that starts out in just a couple weeks and end of April.
It is. I'm looking at a photo of it right now. It is actually pretty remarkable design. So,
mate, it's nothing short of gorgeous. It looks awesome.
Yeah,
it's really. We had a really great night. Fans all went nuts for it, and for the Fury jersey. Those are both available now, and they're really great.
Nice.
Dan, well, you're a soccer fan.
Yeah.
You love footy.
Yeah.
A lot of jerseys are pretty crap. This is not crap.
No, this is. I also think too that it's a soccer jersey. I mean, this is actually their home jersey. It's not like a third jersey. So, you know, like to devote your home jersey to a meaningful design. I mean, there are, you know, my favorite football club, Liverpool Football. You know, I don't really want the traditional red jersey messed with, but you know what? Nobody ever consults or does anything meaningful with the second and third kits, you know, because it's all just designed to sell more kits. So, respect, brother.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was pretty proud of it. And the guys loved it. The guys, we have players from all over across the world, and they just loved it. They love learning about, like, why did we use a sunflower? Why did we use prairie crocus? Why is there beadwork design on it? Kind of thing.
I'd also like to thank you, and I don't want to be too critical, but by using 4 Valor FC players as models for the New Jersey, because I'm sure you were tempted to model it yourself.
Oh,
and I'm sure it looks great on you.
Absolutely nothing would sell if I modeled it myself. Anyways, thanks for doing all the heavy lifting with Minister Sala this week and doing the feature interview and also doing lockup. So sort of giving us the primer on the budget. Huge thanks to everybody at the Free Press for continuing to support the pod here, especially editor Paul Simin and Wendy Sawatsky, who uploads and gets us all organized. And just everyone over there for all the work that they continue to do. We'll be back in next week or the following week.
Yeah, 2 week clip to see if we could provoke our, Negan and the Lone Ranger Nation. I can't believe I said that.
That's amazing.
No, but that's like everybody says blah, 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 nation, right? And it's like, or they give their podcast listeners like a nickname.
We need to come up with something. But I'd sure like Negan and Lone Ranger Nation. Maybe just the Negan Nation. Maybe just kind of off the second part
there. Yeah, I figured you would come up with that. So anyways, thanks very much.
Would they be Rangers? Would they be our deputies?
Oh, we'll get to that.
Yeah, or we could actually refer to them by the name of he who shall not be mentioned on the podcast. So
that's right.
Tonto. So anyways, thank you, everybody, and we will see you very soon.